June 2nd, 2007. San Francisco, California. Hugues de la Plaza, a 36-year-old sound engineer with dual French and American citizenship, returns to his apartment after spending the evening at a club. When morning hits, Hugues is found stabbed to death. Since the security camera shows no one else heading in the direction of Hugues' apartment that night, police explore the possibility that Hugues committed suicide and his death is classified as undetermined. However, Hugues' family discover disturbing discrepancies which suggest he was murdered and are forced to bring in the national police from France to conduct a proper investigation. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today we will be covering a case which was requested a few months ago by a French listener named Thierry, the suspicious 2007 death of Hugues de la Plaza. The victim here was originally born in France, but moved to the United States and attained dual citizenship. His death has received some mainstream coverage in North America and was the subject of an episode of 48 Hours in 2009. But due to the controversial nature of this case, it has gotten a lot more play in the French media. Now, I know I've been critical of police investigations in some of the previous cases I've covered, and I don't want anyone to think I have some sort of anti-law enforcement stance. Most of the time, they do a phenomenal job. However, this particular case contains what is undoubtedly the worst police investigation I've ever featured on this podcast, and I guarantee that your head is going to explode when you hear some of the conclusions these investigators reach. But I'll provide details momentarily. Before we get started, let me get some business out of the way. The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast which alternates between our regular full-length episodes and 15 to 20-minute minisodes. We deliver either a new full-length episode or new minisode every Wednesday. We're currently available for download on several platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play Music. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it. The Trail Went Cold also has its own PayPal account and a donate button on the website. If there's anyone out there who's feeling generous and wants to make a donation, we would greatly appreciate it, and we'll be sure to give you a shout-out on a future episode. We also received a pair of new donations this week from listeners named Catherine and Coleman, so thank you very much, guys. Your generosity is awesome. So with all that out of the way, let us now examine the bizarre death of Hugues de la Plaza. Our story begins in 2007 in San Francisco, California. Our central figure is 36-year-old Hugues de la Plaza, who works as a sound engineer for a company which produces children's educational products. Hugues was originally born in the Brittany region of France, but moved to the United States in 1998 to pursue his career in sound engineering, and he eventually attained dual citizenship. On the evening of June 1st, Hugues went out for a date with a woman he met online, but apparently, things did not go too well, and they went their separate ways. So Hugues decided to go join his friends at a nightclub called the Underground SF. He had recently received a promotion at work and was in the mood to celebrate, so he partook in a lot of drinking and got fairly intoxicated. At around 1:45 a.m., Hugues left the club and parted ways with his friends before walking back to his apartment in the Hayes Valley neighborhood, which was 3/4 of a mile away. And unfortunately, this would be the last time they ever saw him alive. At around 8:20 that morning, one of Hugues' neighbors noticed blood on the stoop outside his apartment, and a small blood trail leading to the front door, so he called 911. The police soon arrived and discovered that there was also blood on the doorknob. The police received no answer to repeated knocks, and since the apartment door was locked, they burst inside and discovered Hugues' dead body resting against a wall. He had been stabbed 3 times, once in the abdomen, once in the chest, and once in the left side of his neck. There was a large amount of blood all over the apartment, including bloody footprints, bloody handprints, and blood smears on the wall next to Oog's body. So Dr. Venus Azar, the assistant medical examiner, arrived at the scene, and she would become quite a controversial figure in this case for reasons I'll get into later. At first, Dr. Azar seemed pretty certain that Oog's death was a homicide. There were signs of struggle inside the apartment, including an overturned TV set and a broken wine glass. Oog's wristwatch had also been crushed and was on the ground beneath him instead of his wrist. But the more Dr. Azar looked at things, the more questions she had. On the surface, this seemed to be a locked room mystery. As I've mentioned before on previous podcasts, locked room mysteries are a popular trope in fiction, where a victim is found murdered inside a room which was locked from the inside, seemingly making it impossible for their killer to have left the scene. Well, the front door to Oog's apartment was deadbolted when the police arrived, and it turned out the back door to the kitchen was locked as well. So if someone murdered Oog, how did they exit the apartment? Azar believed the blood evidence did not support a violent struggle, as there were no high-velocity blood stains to be found. The blood on the ground also appeared to be circular rather than a more elliptical shape. According to Azar, this indicated that Oog was moving slowly while he bled, which goes against the idea that he was fighting for his life with an assailant. Oog's cell phone was on the coffee table and had no bloody handprints on it, and Dr. Azar found it strange that he never made any attempt to call 911. All the bloody shoe prints, hair, and DNA found inside the apartment matched Oog, and the San Francisco PD would claim they found no physical evidence pointing to the existence of an intruder. It was odd that blood was found on the stoop outside the apartment, but it clearly belonged to Oog, since there was no blood trail leading away from the stoop. There was also no signs of robbery, as Oog's wallet and valuables were left behind, so what would have been the motive to kill him? But the thing which really caused investigators to lean the other way was footage from a security camera located above the sidewalk near the apartment. The footage showed Oog returning at 2:06 a.m., but did not show anyone else heading in the direction of his apartment at all until the police arrived that morning. So as crazy as it sounds, the police started leaning towards the theory that Oog stabbed himself and committed a very bizarre suicide. Of course, none of Oog's friends and family believed he was the type of person who would commit suicide, since he was a fun-loving guy who enjoyed life, and things were going well for him at the time. He had just spent the night partying with friends to celebrate a promotion at work, and even made plans with one of his friends for the following day, so it seemed very strange that he would suddenly decide to return home and stab himself to death. But putting aside the issue of whether Oog would have been compelled to take his own life, there was a considerable hole in the suicide theory. If Oog stabbed himself to death, why wasn't a knife found near his body? Investigators toyed with the idea that Oog could have hidden or buried the knife somewhere, or thrown it out the window, but no knife was ever found, and there's no way Oog could have traveled very far to dispose of it without leaving a considerable blood trail. Now, to be fair, there were three knives found in the kitchen, which Oog theoretically could have used to inflict the wounds on himself, but the problem was that there was no blood on any of them. However, since one of these knives was found in the sink, the police had their own theory, and wait until you get a load of this. According to investigators, Oog grabbed one of the knives from the kitchen, stabbed himself three times through the abdomen, chest, and neck, and then washed all the blood off this knife and left it in the sink. Oh, and since Oog's blood was found on the stoop, he must have either stabbed himself there, or gone outside for some inexplicable reason after inflicting his wounds, before walking back inside the apartment, deadbolting the door, and curling up against the wall to die. No, seriously, they really pushed this theory. Because obviously, anyone who's bleeding to death after stabbing themselves three times is going to be so concerned about being hygienic, and will use their dying moments to ensure the knife is properly cleaned. Now you see why I referred to this as the worst police investigation ever featured on this podcast. So how could the San Francisco PD have possibly arrived at a conclusion like that? Well, one of Oog's biggest advocates has been Melissa Nix, who worked as a reporter for the Sacramento Bee at the time, and also happened to be Oog's ex-girlfriend. They were in a relationship for 4 years before they broke up, but in spite of this, they remained good friends, and Melissa still had strong feelings for Oog. Melissa also had the daunting task of phoning Oog's parents, François and Mireille de la Plaza in France, to inform them that their son had been killed, which was especially tragic since Oog was their only child. But to Melissa's surprise, She learned that no one from the San Francisco PD had attempted to contact Oog's parents at all, even though he had already been dead for 2 days at this point. So this was obviously a major red flag that investigators were not taking things as seriously as they should have. Believe it or not, the lead inspector on the case, Antonio Casillas, claimed it was Melissa who first put the suicide idea into his head. When Casillas questioned Melissa, he claimed that she started talking about Oog's obsession with Japanese culture and samurai movies, and how he'd become quite fascinated by the concept of harikiri. In case you didn't know, harikiri is a Japanese method of ritualistic suicide which originated from the samurai Bushido honor code, where someone would take their own life by voluntarily stabbing themselves in the abdomen. So maybe this was what compelled Oog to kill himself in such a gruesome fashion. Of course, Melissa claimed that Casillas was the one who led her into the discussion about suicide, and other witnesses would claim that Casillas questioned them about the possibility of Oog committing suicide long before he even spoke to Melissa. Because really, there is a huge difference between being fascinated by harikiri and actually going through with the process of ripping apart your own abdomen with a knife. The three stab wounds on Oog were so severe that it just seemed unlikely they could be self-inflicted. In particular, the wound on Oog's neck severed an artery and caused him to lose so much blood that he probably would have only lived for another minute or two and wouldn't have had the wherewithal to wash the knife before he died. And there were also a few injuries on his body which could not be explained and appeared to be defensive wounds, including a bruise on his right forearm. Well, believe it or not, another crazy theory that Inspector Casillas proposed was that Oog could have purchased some sort of psychotic drug before he returned to his apartment, and this drug was so dangerous that it caused Oog to go ballistic and stab himself multiple times. However, a toxicology report would reveal that there were no drugs in Oog's system. It is true that no one in the area heard any cries for help that night, but a couple who lived in the apartment next to Oog claimed that at 2:38 a.m., a half hour after he arrived home, they were awakened by a loud thud outside their window. This was followed by various noises which sounded like a door opening and closing multiple times, a person running down the stairs, and someone loudly falling over. The couple didn't think these noises were suspicious enough to call the police at the time, but in hindsight, they pointed towards someone else being at Oog's apartment that night. Nevertheless, it was apparent that the police had developed tunnel vision about Oog committing suicide. While Dr. Venus Azar didn't think there was strong enough evidence to support an official suicide ruling, she also didn't think there was strong enough evidence to support a homicide ruling either. So in the end, Oog's official cause of death was classified as undetermined. Well, needless to say, Oog's father, François de la Plaza, did not find this ruling to be acceptable, so he hired his own private investigator to look into things. Remarkably, the San Francisco PD never bothered to check Oog's phone or computer records, so the PI was forced to do so himself. He discovered that shortly after Oog returned to his apartment after 2:06 a.m., he logged into his computer to browse some dating and sex websites, and he also made himself some food, which again, seemed like pretty strange things to do if you're planning on committing suicide. Given that his blood was found outside on the stoop, it seemed likely that Oog left the apartment for some reason, probably at 2:38 when the neighbors heard some loud noises. It was here that Oog was stabbed by an unknown assailant, compelling him to go back inside his apartment and deadbolt the door to protect himself, which would explain why the apartment was locked when help arrived that morning. The police always stated that the biggest piece of evidence against there being an assailant is that no one else besides Oog showed up on the security camera that night. But when you actually look at the surveillance footage, you'll see that the statement is rather misleading. The camera only captures an overhead shot of the sidewalk a few steps away from Oog's apartment, but the apartment's stoop is not actually featured at all. When you see the overall layout of the street and the apartment, I just don't see how it's impossible that someone could have approached the apartment from the opposite direction, climbed under the stoop to commit the murder, and then fled without being captured on camera. But in spite of the findings from the private investigator, the San Francisco PD still refused to investigate Oog's case as a homicide, so François decided to seek help from his native country and asked the national police from France if they would get involved. Now, you'd think there's no way that a police force from a foreign country would be allowed to travel to the United States and conduct their own investigation in the jurisdiction of an American police department, but because of a rarely used international treaty, they were able to make this happen. The French National Police came over and conducted a much more thorough investigation than the San Francisco PD ever did, interrogating over 50 people and re-examining all the evidence. There was a big dispute over the physical evidence because even though the SFPD maintained that the only DNA found in the apartment matched Oog, there were allegations that they had not done a very thorough job at securing and processing the crime scene. So the issue went to federal court, and in 2009, a judge ruled that the San Francisco PD would have to pack up all the forensic evidence in this case and send it to Paris, so that the National Police Force would have an opportunity to examine it. New DNA testing was finally performed, which led to a surprising discovery. There was DNA on Oog's wristwatch which did not belong to him. Like I said earlier, Oog's watch was not on his wrist, but was found crushed on the ground beneath him. When you combine this with the unexplained bruise found on Oog's forearm, this strongly suggested that Oog's watch had been broken and detached from his wrist during a struggle with an attacker, who left their DNA behind on the watch. In the end, the French authorities released a 2,000-page report of their findings and concluded that Oog's death was most definitely a homicide. Around the same time, the San Francisco PD commissioned their own private review of the case from an independent medical examiner. They were probably hoping for a ruling in their favor, but this medical examiner also concluded that Oog had been murdered. The SFPD then decided to withhold this report from Oog's family for months, and they only learned about it after 48 hours obtained a copy of the report. In response to these findings, the De La Plaza family offered a $100,000 reward for information, and Melissa Nix asked a civilian-run watchdog agency called the Office of Citizens' Complaints to launch their own independent investigation. They ruled that the San Francisco Police Department had been completely negligent with their investigation into Oog's death, and the whole thing turned into a national embarrassment for them. All that being said, even though Oog's family and friends finally received validation that he was murdered, this didn't bring them any closer to figuring out who actually killed him. The San Francisco PD have failed to turn up any new leads within the past several years, and they're probably still hoping the whole thing will just go away. The case hasn't received a lot of play in the American media in recent years, but the French media still gives it some coverage every now and then, as they've never gotten over the fact that one of their own citizens was murdered on American soil, and the French authorities made the American authorities look like such incompetent amateurs. But unfortunately, there still haven't been any major developments in the case for quite some time. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. Yeah, I've seen a lot of cases where a person died under suspicious circumstances and the authorities ruled suicide, but I can't think of another one where it was so blatantly obvious that the victim was murdered. The whole thing caused such a unique international incident. You've probably heard a lot of stories where an American citizen was murdered or went missing in a foreign country, most famously the Natalie Holloway case, and the victim's family became frustrated by the corruption or ineptitude of the local authorities. But this is the exact opposite situation, where a citizen from a foreign country died under suspicious circumstances in the United States, and his family was frustrated by the ineptitude of the American authorities. You know the San Francisco PD dropped the ball in a huge way when a foreign police force is actually given permission to intervene in their investigation. It seems unfathomable that they could have been so wrong when there was just so much evidence pointing to a homicide, but I think there was a reason for this debacle which had nothing to do with ineptitude. At the time, San Francisco was experiencing a serious homicide problem, and the SFPD had one of the worst closure rates of any police force in the country. In 2007 alone, San Francisco had 100 murders, and only about 25% of them wound up being prosecuted. In comparison, the national average for closing homicides that year in the U.S. was 53%. Whether it be a lack of resources or just general incompetence, the SFPD obviously had some serious issues, and when this happens, police departments will often take shortcuts to keep their crime rates down. If you've ever watched The Wire, you'll probably remember the term juking the stats. One of the running themes on that show was how obsessed the higher-ups in Baltimore became with their crime stats, as they constantly dream up tricks and shortcuts to give off the false impression that violent crime in their city was down. Well, this type of strategy does occur in real-life police departments, especially when things aren't going well, and it certainly would have rang true for the San Francisco PD in 2007. When they saw the bloody scene at Oog de la Plaza's apartment, they probably thought it would be a difficult case to solve, and looked at the victim as another stat in their escalating unsolved murder rate. So they decided to juke the stats a bit by coming up with ways to twist the evidence and make it sound like Oog's death might be a suicide, or at the very least, undetermined. When the death is officially classified as undetermined, then technically it doesn't count as part of their murder stats. It's been theorized that one of the reasons they chose to use this strategy on Oog was because he was a French citizen who didn't have any family living in the US, so they probably figured there wouldn't be much resistance if his case was quietly closed. Of course, this whole strategy just blew up in their faces when François de la Plaza got the French authorities involved, and their thorough investigation just made the San Francisco PD look very, very bad. But there's an additional layer of drama here. It turns out that Dr. Venus Azar, the assistant medical examiner who classified Oog's death as undetermined, she was carrying on an affair at the time with lead inspector Antonio Casillas. Remember, Dr. Azar admitted that when she first arrived at the scene, she was certain it was a homicide, but gradually changed her mind. Well, I'll say that a lot of Azar's reasons for leaning towards suicide seem very thin to me. I really don't see why it was suspicious that Oog never attempted to use his cell phone to call 911, as he probably just died before he even got the opportunity. None of her points cancel out the important fact that Oog did not have a bloody knife to stab himself with. But if Azar was romantically involved with the lead inspector, then it's easy to see how he might have influenced her into not ruling the death to be a homicide. This is actually not the only case from this time period where it's been alleged that Casillas influenced a questionable ruling that Azar made. Whatever their motivation was, if you watch the 48 Hours episode on Oog's case, it's undeniable that Casillas and Azar both come off really badly when trying to defend their decisions. I read a great quote in an article from SF Weekly which perfectly summarized the piss-poor investigation. The police have exerted a great deal of effort in justifying why they've exerted so little effort in resolving De La Plaza's death. However, while criticism of the SFPD's investigation is justified, you can't deny that there are a lot of bizarre things about this crime. Technically, this is still a locked room mystery, as a murdered man was found in an apartment which was locked from the inside, which on the surface seems impossible. However, I do feel that a lot of the theories pushed forward by the French National Police and François de la Plaza's private investigator are probably accurate. Oog probably got back to his apartment, and everything went normally for a half hour or so until he was lured outside. He probably heard a knock and opened his door, but when he stepped out onto the stoop, an assailant attacked him with a knife, which accounts for all the blood found there. After he was wounded, Oog probably went back into the apartment to protect himself, though there's still debate about whether his attacker followed him inside. It's possible that Oog deadbolted the door to keep the attacker out, but I think there's enough evidence to suggest that at least one of Oog's stab wounds occurred inside the apartment. Since Oog's broken wristwatch was found on the floor beneath him, I think that supports the idea of a violent struggle indoors. Also, the neighbors remembered hearing what sounded like the door opening and closing multiple times. I think Oog was probably still alive when the attacker fled, and had enough instinct to deadbolt the door in case the attacker came back. But he probably didn't hang on much longer, and died almost immediately after locking the door. So while it now seems pretty clear-cut that Oog de la Plaza was murdered, the big issue here is that nobody has the slightest idea who might be responsible. And that is definitely the most baffling aspect of this mystery. Even after the French National Police inserted themselves into the case and performed a first-rate investigation, they still never uncovered a solid suspect for the murder. It seems there are two prevalent theories. The first theory stems from the fact that Oog's apartment was located on a street adjacent to the Western Addition District, which is considered to be one of the most dangerous neighborhoods in San Francisco. Oog was walking alone through a less-than-great area at 2 a.m., so it's possible that someone could have seen Oog and decided to follow him back to his apartment to murder him. But as far as I'm concerned, this theory really doesn't hold much water. Nothing was stolen, so there doesn't seem to be any motive for a random stranger to murder Oog, unless it was a thrill killer or something. It seems probable that Oog was lured outside, but I just don't see him opening his door for someone at 2:30 in the morning unless he knew them personally. There's also the fact that the security camera overlooking the sidewalk didn't capture anyone else but Oog approaching his apartment. I don't believe it's impossible that someone else could have made it to the apartment without showing up in the footage, but I do think that if a stranger was following Oog home, they would have taken the same route he did, and passed right underneath that camera. I just have a feeling that Oog's murder was not random, and that it was connected to something in his personal life. Since this was such a brutal, vicious stabbing, the crime seemed very personal in nature, so I believe the second main theory about what happened is a lot more plausible. Virtually all of Oog's friends stated that he was a major womanizer who frequently went online to date and hook up with as many women as possible. And it sounds like he was mostly interested in sex, not finding a serious relationship. However, Oog's friends were concerned that he was going to burn himself out because there were times when it seemed like he was practically seeing a new woman every night. At one point, one of his friends asked if he would ever date someone else's woman, and without hesitation, Oog replied yes. So that opens up numerous possibilities. I guess the ironic thing is that on the surface, it would seem that Melissa Nix, Oog's former girlfriend of 4 years, might have the perfect motive for murder, yet she has fought harder than anybody to keep this case in the spotlight. It doesn't sound like anybody in Oog's life has pointed authorities towards a strong suspect who disliked him and would want him dead, but given his constant philandering, it would have been very easy for Oog's to anger someone without even realizing it. Oog's killer could have been a jilted lover, or even the enraged spouse of one of the women he was involved with. This angle should have been looked at immediately, but unfortunately, the San Francisco PD did not bother to check Oog's phone or computer records to dig up info on all the women he was interacting with. By the time the French National Police got involved, some of these leads might have gone cold. While this part of the investigation has failed to turn up any suspects or persons of interest, I have to believe that the murder is somehow connected to Oog's love life. I'm sure the National Police looked into this angle as much as they could, but given how extensive it was, Oog could have had some hookups or connections they never even found out about. I just don't think anyone would have attacked Oog in such a brutal fashion unless they truly felt that he had wronged them. And I think it's likely that Oog knew his killer, because he probably wouldn't have opened his front door and walked outside at 2:30 in the morning unless he saw someone there he was familiar with. Well, it might just be blind luck that the killer was never captured by the outside security camera. I can't overlook the possibility that this person had frequented Oog's apartment before. They might have known the layout, and deliberately made sure not to step into the range of the camera. I know it's been mentioned that before he went to the nightclub, Oog had a date with a woman which did not go well. I've never learned specific details about this, but I'd like to think that this woman was thoroughly investigated and questioned at some point. But like I said earlier, the big problem is that Oog hooked up with so many different women that his friends likely weren't even aware of all of them. So some of these women have probably never been questioned or eliminated as suspects simply because no one knows of their connection to Oog. And if this is true, I'd wager that one of these women, or possibly one of their spouses, is responsible for Oog's murder. On the bright side, while we don't know the actual identity of Oog's killer, we do have their DNA on his broken wristwatch, and if that DNA can be matched to anyone, it probably won't be hard to secure an arrest and a conviction on that person. The authorities just have to figure out who they are. In a few months, we will reach the 10-year anniversary of Oog's death, but unfortunately, investigators don't seem to be any closer to uncovering a suspect. So if you have any hard information about the murder of Oog de la Plaza, please contact the appropriate authorities. I really hope you won't have to go so far as to contact France and get the National Police involved, but it would be nice if Oog's family and friends could have closure someday. However, if you just have your own theory about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email at robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. I want to thank all my loyal listeners and supporters out there, especially those from the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum, and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. And I also want to provide a shout-out to a Facebook group I recently joined called Podcasts We Listen To, where fellow podcasters like myself and podcast listeners assemble to discuss the medium. I found a lot of fans of The Trail Went Cold in that group, so thank you for your support, guys. I also need to provide a big thank you to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or a review on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play Music. And like I mentioned earlier, we also have a donate button on our website, so if you're feeling generous and want to express your appreciation for all the hard work we put into this podcast, we'd be extremely grateful. So have yourself a good week, and join me next Wednesday for a brand new minisode of The Trail Went Cold. Thank you.